You're listening to Time Lost, a poetry podcast by Perdu, Center for Poetry and Experimentation in Amsterdam. We invite authors to undust a work that has gone unpublished or was unpublishable in the first place. Every episode, you'll be hearing a work that is now being granted a second chance.
Hello, welcome to Time Lost, a podcast by Perdu. My name is Ollie Patterson, and in this episode, we are joined by none other than Dodi Bellamy. Thank you, Dodi, for joining me, and how are you doing today?
Oh, good. It's nice to be up. It's a beautiful day.
So I was thinking we could just dive right into it, and I was wondering if maybe you could speak about where this work exists, maybe on the spectrum of unpublished and unpublishable.
Okay, well, what I'm going to read today is a section from an unfinished novel that I abandoned in the late 90s. And so a number of sections of it were published in little magazines. And there was one section called Fat Chance that was a chapbook. But I abandoned the project. So this is from the end, which I just had notes for, was never published anywhere. And so it was interesting to go back to the work right now. So
nice. Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's a very kind of intimate and private story, and I was wondering maybe how does knowing that it's going to be published or that it's going to be out there in some way potentially change the way that you approach the work, or is there a censorship there or anything like that?
It's very personal material. Well, it's very personal material, but I would say that it feels very personal to the protagonist, even though it's obviously based on journals that I actually wrote. They were all taken out of context and it's edited, so it doesn't really feel like me at all. I mean, I can't hardly relate to her at this point, but so that makes it really kind of fun. Like, as opposed to writing it when you're in the thick of it and you're into all those emotions and stuff. So I think I haven't shown it to, it's funny because I had some people who wanted to see it, but I haven't shown it to anybody. I don't know why. I was just resistant to sending it to anybody. So you're the only person who's read it so far.
Oh, nice. Cool. I feel privileged. That's wicked. Well, that's interesting. So it did look like, because of the dates that you put on it, it looked like it was written in 1997. And I could also tell by the fact that Contact, the film that you're talking about at the end, which is a great film, by the way, came out then.
It is very much a historical novel at this point. About the very early days of internet. Like internet in terms of when it moved out of just academics being online to people like me being online. So
yeah, just like very much, obviously nothing exists in a vacuum. So if there's no more context you want to add before you read it, then would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, maybe I'll just give the plot of the book is these two people meet online and they have all sorts of basically email sex, because, you know, back then it was all text-based. It wasn't visual, and people wrote long, long letters, and it was a very different culture. And then there's sections that are about, like, weird email sex, and then there's, like, phone sex, and then there's this section where they go on a road trip, and it's called Mirror Life, because it's so much less interesting than the other sex. And then, you know, of course it ends. And so this is her afterwards. She can't get over him for reasons unknown to me at this point. And so she goes to this like cheap Chinese restaurant that doesn't exist anymore and basically eats tofu and vegetables and brown rice and drinks cheap white wine, writes in her journal, and then goes and throws up. And so the piece is called Vomit Journal. You can already see how problematic this is. So so I think that's enough context. So should I start reading?
Yeah. I think that was a perfect summation. But yeah, go for it. Go ahead.
4/14/97. Sitting at the Hong Kong, gorging on bean curd with Chinese broccoli. I'm so tired of my own thoughts. I've run out of things to say about Ed. No matter which way I turn, I smack against the incomprehensible fact that I'm the only one doing the missing here. To him, I'm nothing but a case of brain fever, a burning hallucination his medication wiped out. I'm lighting small fires in the snow, he wrote me, during our final death pangs. His drugs were the snow, rendering everything icy and white. After we broke up, he started reading books on the theory of otherness and went to Poland and slept with a crazy cousin he didn't remember from his childhood. He told me this during our last phone conversation, which lasted 2 hours. You seem quiet, he said. Are you upset? The note of pleasure in his voice unmistakable. This is a BNP night, binge and purge. He's chose Cynthia for his therapist, he said, because he needed an attractive woman to help him work through his problems with his girlfriend, with women. In the early days, he confided in Cynthia that he was attracted to her. She was my age. She ignored him. Cynthia was a traitor to women, helping him fuck over and dump his first girlfriend, then me. The bathroom keeps being busy like it's fucking Grand Central Station. When the next person comes out, I'll bolt. I envy Ed's total reliance on Cynthia. 3 fortunes in my cookie today. Your dearest wish will come true. 7, 9, 13, 16, 47, 48. Blue will be your lucky color. Beneath this, a row of Chinese characters. Be moderate where pleasure is concerned. More Chinese characters. 4/17/97, Hong Kong. I'm feeling like such a freak. Earlier I was reading about barrel pillories. They were mostly used for drunks. The barrel fit over the drunk's body, his head poking out of a hole in the top. Sometimes there were holes in the front just big enough for hands. Sometimes there were scenes painted on the side depicting the drunk's transgressions. I want to extend this metaphor like crazy. My life is a humiliation barrel. My body is a humiliation barrel, and so is this journal. The rough wood shapes my tenderness. Just spilled wine all over my chest. You have a keen sense of humor and a love of a good time. 220, 21, 31, 34, 36. I don't remember getting a 3-digit number before. 4/23/97, Hong Kong. Wasn't planning to come here, but suddenly I was so hungry, had such a desire to be alone. Was planning to stay home and cook some spaghetti, but that wouldn't be alone enough. I'm eating like a pig and daydreaming. I feel like a root reaching deep into my private insanity. There's a guy across the aisle, one table ahead of me, who's writing in a notebook with a glossy red cover, blue grid paper. He's wearing a dark neutral cardigan with a collar, full beard, kind of bushy hair. When I came in, I thought to myself, he's crazy, but he's acting normal enough, scooping vegetarian chop suey onto a heap of steamed rice, dousing it with vinegar, soy sauce, and hot chili oil, scooping bean sprouts into his mouth with chopsticks. No purpose in writing about him, but I like him in here with me. And know the thought of fucking him is not appealing. Ed destroyed that part of me. The guy's very good with chopsticks. Sometimes I wish I had a marginal social life rather than the spoiled artsy-fartsies I hang out with. People that would interest and stimulate me. His eyes are bright, wiping his mouth with an orange hanky. More vinegar and soy sauce. I watch him with the same distracted pleasure as I watch my cats basking in the sun. This glorious isness. The world as a 3D movie with no plot. Therefore, limitlessly engaging. A kaleidoscope of not me, ever shifting. My eyes are so wide, I can't get enough of watching. My fortune cookie is so sweet, so crispy. Your talents will be recognized and suitably rewarded. 1, 3, 32, 33, 40, 43. Competition for the restroom today is fierce. 5, 5, 97. Hong Kong. Stuffing my face with broccoli, a bit of hot pepper caught in my throat, tearing my eyes. It has become so much a character that it's hard to believe a real person ever existed. He's more like a portfolio of received details, like the scribbles of a paranoid old woman Jackie found in her attic, tiny penciled notations on random scraps of paper of what the neighbors were viciously gossiping about, what the tea kettle was whispering. Details Ed told me about his life, my memories of him, are emails, phrases copied from Schreiber's memoirs. They're all the same, minutia, to fortify my constructions. Your present plans are going to succeed. 1, 3, 11, 13, 46, 4. 5, 6, 97. Hong Kong. Yes, 2 days in a row. Ah, the creamy warmth of tofu, the garlicky bite, rather smoky, of red chili oil. Soft tofu is vegetarian oysters, slipping across the back of your tongue. Writing is the one reason I have to live, the one place where I feel a reason. Catherine Wagner's photograph of the Human Genome Project's freezer packed with tissue samples. When I noticed that some are labeled bipolar disorder, I ripped the page right out of the magazine and pinned it on the wall beside my computer. I still haven't reached the essence of the photograph, why I desire it, even though it's sterile and ugly. Frozen vials, frozen emotion. In the freezer's absolute negative 86 degree coldness, clutter coalesces into order. Its frost-tinged immobility reminds me of the dead body in Plath's poem Edge. The woman is perfected. The illusion of Greek necessity flows in the scrolls of her toga. There's a lesson about writing here. A vial labeled bipolar disorder is infinitely closer to Ed's hyperventilating panic, the flush of his capillaries, the stench of his drug-induced diarrhea than anything I could say about him. Thingness, frozen and sliced, versus my fancifications. Vial AA1 meets vial AA5 on shelf number 3. They fall in love and move to shelf number 2, tube holder B. AA5 leaves AA1. Immobilized with frost, AA1 reads her fortune cookie. It has 2 fortunes, meaning there's no easy answers. You will be showered with good luck, line of Chinese characters. Do not let unexpected situations throw you, more characters. 5, 8, 97. The coolness of the page against my hand, the whiteness. The words seem to emerge from beneath the page, my golden pinpoint, a dowsing rod, drawing them forth. I wish I had a lover, not necessarily physical, to whom I was giving all my words, for whom I peel off my skin like a tangerine. Audience. That has always been the lover's main function for me. Writing in this diary, I feel like the tree crashing in an empty forest. With no one to hear me, do I make a sound? I don't have much to say, just the urge to linger in this stillness, this coolness. Wish my hand would zip across the page in a frenzy of automatic writing, and I could sit back and watch the words materialize, indifferent yet surprised. A cheerful letter or message is on its way to you. Line of Chinese characters. 6, 2, 97. The broccoli bean cake is particularly good tonight. Watching people dining together, I feel envious, like friendship and sharing food is the most precious thing in the world. Longing never seems to leave me. It just gets locked away somewhere in the body, Writing about Ed, the fatty seal breaks and loss comes rushing through, flushing my chest. As details come into focus, my mouth spasms. Marijuana ashes on the bottom shelf of his medicine cabinet. The copper lobster mold I bought at the Salvation Army, I imagine is no longer hanging on the kitchen wall. Pauline Oliveros on the stereo. Hundreds of books of poetry in the living room, the bedroom, his tiny study off the kitchen, all of them blonde, collapsible shelves he bought at Kmart. His things seem more real than he. I don't think I could love anybody who was normal, who hadn't suffered terribly. The trouble with all of us outsiders is that we're always trying to hide our freakishness, striving to attain the status of normalcy. We may be able to understand one another, but ultimately, we're not on one another's agenda. Most likely, I'd have come to despise Ed for not being powerful, for being such a weirdo. Last night, I dreamt I was having trouble shitting, and I began pulling whole cabbage leaves out of my butt. I showed them to Ed, and he said I needed to chew my food better. Your present plans are going to succeed. 1, 3, 11, 13, 46, 47. I love it when I get a fortune with numbers in it. It's like communicating with beings from a different realm. As Jodie Foster says in the preview to the movie about alien transmission, mathematics is the only universal language. Okay, that's the end.
Thank you very much. I love the tone, like, and the humor and the way this piece just moves. It's great. So thank you for sending it and for sharing it with us.
No, I think thank you for giving me the opportunity to overcome my great resistance and look at the material.
Nice. I'm glad this was an opportunity to dive back into it. That's interesting that this was written in 97. And I'm wondering, because we were talking before, just before you read, about the context around it, about it being at the beginning of the internet, and, you know, this kind of letter making and writing and stream of consciousness kind of stuff coming through around this time. I'm wondering, having edited it recently, has your approach to, I mean, well, having a few years in between, does that then alter the way that you approach it? Does that change the meaning? Do you taper it into sort of a different direction as you've changed in that time?
One thing I was noticing, even like reading it today, is how different the writing process is now. Like, oh, well, maybe I should quote Sylvia Plath Edge. Couple clicks, I have that. And then I had no memory of barrel pillories. So I have much more detail about the barrel pillories in this version than what I had there. And so the way that information was so accessible. And the Catherine Wagner photo, I think I probably still have it somewhere, but I don't. So I could look up Catherine Wagner's, you know, website and find the whole background on it that I didn't remember. So that was really interesting. But I part of the problem is I wanted to write this piece. I don't know how long it could be. I don't think it could be 130 pages, the vomit journal. Who knows? But it was sort of like, well, where's the narrative arc? You know, like in some way, I sort of felt like, okay, she's writing this because she can't get over this guy. And at some point in the regular novel, she would have some realization and grow and change and move on. But that wasn't happening for me. And now I have no problem with that. That's kind of what's great about it, is that it just goes on and on and on and nothing's going to change, you know. She's and also I think that the journals are much more interesting to me now than they were back then. I think the writing is actually surprisingly to me interesting, and there's a lot of pleasure in it. So
to return to it and like to see how not only your approach to writing has changed, but also the approach to writing in general as the world now exists with the advancement of technology.
Well, and also I actually just have done a lot more writing since then.
Yeah.
I'm more competent. You know, I think the project overall was like perhaps too ambitious for me. Like the earlier stuff that have been published in sections, there's some brilliant stuff in there, but it is really redundant. It really needs to be cut down and shaped and those types of things. So
yeah,
a lot of it was, yeah, not knowing like how to like end it, which isn't a problem now. And then also, you know, the Ed character, I changed him. So it's based on a real person, but I kept changing him and changing him and making him more and more a character rather than a person that anybody would recognize. But then he keeps like writing, telling everybody that this is him. Like he doesn't, no matter how much I change it, he sees this as like a total journalism about his life.
The actual person that this is based on. Oh, okay.
Still, I mean, it's like, so yeah. That was a problem, right? At one time, I think Eileen Miles said it to me that it's when people start feeling hostile to what you're saying about them is when you learn to write fiction.
That's a great quote. I like that.
You know, so yeah, you know, like I was raised in a little literary bubble where everybody was writing about everybody else, and to be in somebody's piece was like this badge of honor. But the rest of the world doesn't feel that way, and it is weird to have somebody else do a portrait of you. Like like people, including myself, who've been in documentaries, or I know someone who's being interviewed to be in The New Yorker, which sounds like the greatest thing on earth. It's torture, let me tell you. they seem like they're going to do this person's life, you know. So,
and do you think maybe that's one of the reasons that on some level this was unpublishable at the time?
I would like list traits and say what's important. And then also at this point, there's other issues with it, and that you know, the person is like it's based on is like bipolar. And probably, you know, by today's standards, I'm sure I say things that are unacceptable. So how do you write about you know, your experience with someone who's going through something like that in the culture now? So then that would have to be really thought about. And I don't know if I want to get rid of that part. I mean, part of me wants to just like clean it up so much that there's nothing interesting about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's everything about it is bad and tasteless, right? And which is, it's the 90s. That's what.
Yeah. It has that kind of grainy feel to it in some way, you know, or gritty. Interesting. And then I guess, do you then feel that that is a space that you're navigating personally with other projects, where I guess your tone of voice in a lot of stuff, well, in your style, I guess, is very kind of, yeah.
Well, they're reprinting, you know, I have two books coming out from Semiotext in October. And one of them's a new book. And then the other one's my first novel, The Letters of Mina Harker, which was published in 98, though the writing of it preceded what we saw now. It took a while to get it published. And so that's like all, you know, lots of outrageous amount of sex in that book. That's just put and so I was just worried, you know, I'm going to get destroyed. But I had a student of mine interviewed me about the book recently. It's going to be on the Small Press Traffic website, and she's like in her 20s, and I asked her, you know, do you think it still holds up, is it okay? And she seemed to think that, you know, Gen Z is all into sex and that I'll be fine, that they'll like it, you know. But yeah, there are those concerns, you know, that things are written in a for a certain culture, and no one now seems to realize that different values existed at different times, you know what I mean? So but I fortunately was involved in a writing scene that was very much about politics and concerned about other people's experiences in a with a different kind of vocabulary than now. So that, but at the same time, it's a book that's whole point is to be outrageous.
Yeah. And I guess that was like a lot of the point of New Narrative, right? Is to be in your face, and it was to be brazen about sex and about all of these, you know, all of these things, and be explicit. So I guess maybe where do obviously the movement influenced you a great deal after 1997-ish, sort of when it became a little bit more dispersed. Where did you move from there as a writer, as an artist?
I just sort of wanted to kind of explore my own like kind of voice, and Kevin Killian, who is my husband, who I met in a workshop, a New Narrative writing workshop, he was very supportive in me kind of going in my own direction. And one thing that really influenced my writing a lot, and the art scene influenced my writing a lot, and knowing people, the writers in Los Angeles influenced my writing a lot, and they were coming from, which now is being called a punk aesthetic, but back then I didn't consider it that way. But I wrote the book The Buddhist, well, that's only available on Publication Studios, you know, that's a print on demand. It started out as a blog. I used to have this blog that was a similar material to this vomit journal, but it was all about feeling rejected and loss and abjection and kind of doing this public display of abjection. And I called it operatic suffering. And then at a certain point, I was doing sharing an artist, I don't know, it wasn't a residency, I don't know what you would call it, but anyway, we were like kind of, this camera works here would pair an artist and a writer, and they would do something together. And Coulter Jacobson was doing Publication Studio as part of his art practice. So he said, let's make a book out of your blog. And that totally changed the writing. And I found that when I started thinking of it going from blog to book, I was really embarrassed because the writing was straightforward. And I thought about that a lot, that would embarrass me. Mm. There was something wrong there, right? But that, you know, like this sort of, and so after I did that, my writing changed in that I still had all the same concerns and earlier writings about language and experience and abjection and excess. But I learned to like give it more air and to be more accessible, but still get it, do what I'm doing. So it's very interesting, the new book and then having the Mina book published together, because Mina is like, it could be like five books. There's so much material. It's all like compacted. And now I like to write regular sentences and things like that.
Yeah.
It kind of moved me from like kind of a poetry consciousness to a more of a prose consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. And I can see that also reading your earlier stuff and then reading your stuff now, that you've kind of come to this. Yeah, like this is definitely a pattern that like I personally seen emerge. How is your relationship with the poetry consciousness now then? And like, you know, what's the relationship between something that's less esoteric and something that's still getting the point across, but still has all of these parts from this poetry side of you that, you know, you're sort of still drawn towards?
Well, I don't know. I guess what I write, it depends on where it's going, you know, like if I'm writing, like I'm writing a review of an art show now, and I know that I have to behave myself. It's got to be like regular. But I really like writing a lot about art in this kind of other way, like the Catherine Wagner piece. I like writing about it that way. So I don't know. I think that there's the movements. You know, I really do a lot of moving around and put things together that kind of butt up against each other and write a lot of times more thematically than narratively. And so it's basically all the same. It's just how much air and space there is around it. I think my concerns haven't really changed that much. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I also like to work with degraded materials. Like, I really find, like, when women, you know, are being, like, feminist women, and then they start quoting Wittgenstein, drives me fucking crazy. No. Do you know what I mean? Oh, yeah, we need him there to, like, make this okay. And
Yeah.
You see less of that now than you used to, but, you know, I'd rather quote Nick Cave.
You know? Good choice.
Well, he is sort of a centering point of the new book, so.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm excited for it. And what's another example of this degrading material that you're talking about?
Writing about vomiting, for one thing, or writing a lot about pop culture.
Mm-hmm. So like high versus low art sort of type thing. Okay.
But I think one thing I learned about, there's various ways to write about pop culture, and there's a way where you act like you're dominating it somehow, you know, like it's this aesthetic experience, and you know, and then there's a way too that I think is kind of a more queer way to look at it, whereas as something that you're profoundly moved by, and part of the tackiness allows you to be moved. And so I like to approach it that way. And I learned that a lot from, you know, like Kevin, my husband. But also I learned Kathy Acker was really great at that. I thought of looking at something without the filters. So it's kind of this childlike gaze. Mm.
Without that kind of, not snobbishness, but you know what I mean? Like just being able to have no apparatus, coloring it and just experiencing it as a pure state, whatever it is.
She did it like totally libidinal too, you know, so everything is like this childlike sex that is kind of illogical. And so
I guess another thing I wanted to ask was to what degree is the I in this and how far does this relate, like does this person relate to your own experience? Where does this character, what was her name, Kira?
No, Carla.
Carla, yeah.
You know, that's a really interesting question, because at a certain point, especially if you spend as much time editing and writing as I do, 7 hours on this, like, come on, it doesn't look it, right? And
were they continuous hours as well?
Huh?
Was it like one 7-hour block?
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Trooper.
I actually really enjoyed doing it, but at a certain point, even if it was written more contemporaneously, it becomes material. So that I'm writing about myself, but myself doesn't seem to be any different than those Catherine Wagner photograph. It's just a different material that get like really distance from it. And I think you need something like that, or it just does seem, it just kind of, personal writing can kind of collapse into this like kind of babbling narcissism that isn't very interesting, right? Like, when is it interesting and when is it isn't?
Yeah.
Not every time somebody sits down and writes about themselves is it interesting, you know? But then sometimes it's just totally fascinating.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction, to be fair. No, definitely. I mean, and in terms of the way that you approach metaphors, like with the thing with the cars and, you know, reading your work, you've done some crazy, crazy shit with like the, with the metaphors, and somehow you've made them into this beautiful, deeply human thing. I was wondering how did you do that? Your approach to experimentation. In that sense,
just don't do anything else for huge amounts of time, and then the connections happen.
Mm.
That's kind of it. It's just, it becomes like this intense meditation, and then all these, you know, when you're in like the thick of writing, and this is a common experience. Suddenly, like the world, you see all these connections and things come to you that you normally don't see. You kind of almost go in. Sometimes it feels almost like a controlled psychosis. Go into this kind of other realm, and then things just start resonating, and surprises happen. So that's basically what I do. I mean, it's kind of scary at first to start writing because that's not all there. That's not in place. And getting there is not an easy journey. And then once I'm there, it's just really wonderful. I don't want to leave it, but it's very intimidating to go into that state.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you feel that like every day, do you have that, still have that fear of entering the thing again?
Well, I don't write regularly. I kind of binge write.
Okay.
But the problem is that I use the same technique for everything. So I used to write book reviews and it was ridiculous, you know, like I would just spend too much time on them and, you know, the result wouldn't be that great. And I always have to write like three times more than what if I have a 1,000-word thing, I don't sit down and write 1,000 words. I write all this other stuff and then I cut it and shape it. And so I really need to pick my projects because it's not, you know, I'm not a quick writer. I can't sit down and just pound something out.
Mm. Well, there is this kind of, the kind of dark edge to it, really.
It's funny, interesting is that going back to the material, I like her more than she liked herself. And so I can like kind of highlight, you know, and that's another thing, you know, there's parts of it I remember I didn't, where she really goes into the vomiting, you know, and it's described and stuff. And my plan is there's never, ever going to be anything critical said about the vomiting. You know, which is like really un-PC, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, she's in the middle of this thing and it actually gives her pleasure, even though it's a very obviously self-destructive thing that
isn't
sustainable. And, you know, it's just weird that, you know, we'd have to even think about that, like, you know.
Yeah.
Trigger. Don't read this book. If anything ever bothers you, it's in here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It really is a difficult space to navigate, I think, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's, something that a lot of people struggle with, a lot of like maybe your contemporaries or like even just, yeah, just anyone, any authors writing today? Do you think that's something that
they all do?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was interesting that I would have this like 20 some year old person who's a former student read my work and ask her to approve it. And she approved it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, she's very, very conscious of things.
Yeah.
And but there was this one part that the last year or so or 2 years of Kevin's life, we did a lot of these collaborative people kept hiring us to do collaborative essays and some of them were in the form of dialogue. And then like we did this project before he died where we were writing every week on various topics, but it only lasted for like 6 weeks and then he died. So it didn't get that far. So those are very casual. Well, two of them were for art catalogs. So those were like kind of more worked over, but the dialogue between the two of us was casual. And so I didn't do a lot of editing of it. And so my editor's reading it and he goes, "You said that during the AIDS crisis, you had a good time." And so I went back and I edited it. And the new version like clarifies what I was saying and it is better. But I felt really angry that, you know, that anybody who lived during the AIDS crisis has to then rewrite their words about the AIDS crisis according to people who weren't theirs version of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the edited version is better than the original version.
Okay.
The whole thing would be better if it was edited. Part of it, I wasn't. It was consciously. I put those pieces in where there's a dialogue between us because, you know, it's all about loss. So I thought it would be good to have the reader just experience him in the book, not just my reporting of him.
Yeah. 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 And that makes sense, of course, posthumously as well.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't. Yeah. If he hadn't died, I never would have put those in the book.
Yeah.
I'm not a big person.
So, Dodie, thank you very much for coming today. And yeah, it was an absolute pleasure.
Okay. Yeah, it was a pleasure talking to you as well.
You've been listening to Time Lost, a podcast by Purdue. You can find more information about the episode and our guest on our website, purdue.nl. This podcast was created with the support of the Amsterdam Fund for the Arts and the Dutch Foundation for Literature. Thanks for listening, and until the next Time Lost.